You're listening to the Today in Manufacturing podcast.
Hi, I'm David Manti, and welcome to a new episode of the Today in Manufacturing podcast. With me this week are Jeff Ranke and Anna Wells. We each have more than 15 years of experience covering the manufacturing industry. Every week, we take the five most popular stories on our websites and discuss the implications they have on the industry going forward. Before we get started, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You can also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, David, or Anna at IAN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You can also subscribe to our daily newsletter. Make sure you get it delivered to your inbox first. Or subscribe to us on YouTube at IAN Magazine so you can watch us when we go live every Thursday. Jeff, how are you doing this week?
I'm well, David. How about yourself?
I was doing well right until I took a huge gulp of coffee and heard that we had 5 seconds. And I was just like, I got problems.
It did kind of remind me of that Ron Burgundy, like slurping his scotch down right before they go live.
Yeah. I'd be a lot smoother if it was scotch. Just like, as long as we cut right after the, the burn. And how are you doing this week?
Doing fine, thanks. Yeah,
slugging some scotch before we get rolling?
Yeah, as I always do on Thursdays.
Yeah, it's just Anna's afternoon scotch.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Normal.
Standard stuff.
I've reintroduced like office scotch to the snack table. It could be all right for a day.
Ugh.
I don't see any problems at all.
No, thank
any
you.
Any problems at all. You can have yourself some pizza goldfish and a slug of scotch. Like a distinguished folk. All right. Before we get started with our first story this week, we have another word from our sponsor, Rockwell Automation. This week's episode is brought to you by Rockwell Automation, which wants to help you gain unlimited HMI visualization options. This new video podcast, now available on demand, highlights Rockwell's recent rollout of FactoryTalk Optics, a new cloud-enabled HMI product. According to the company, this latest offering centers on improving processes, efficiency, and deliverables by providing new levels of collaboration, scalability, and interoperability. In this podcast, Anna and Jeff talk about it. Anna, what were some of your takeaways from that video podcast?
Well, I don't want to give anything away. I think that the viewers and listeners should check it out for themselves. But I will say that it was, an interesting breakdown of some of the newest technologies coming to the plant floor and how those are being used. So,
all right. Well, if you're interested in checking that out, click the link in the body below in the comments section and check it out. Let us know what you think. All right. Our first story this week. U.S. solar company who filed bankruptcy in 2018 to reopen idled factory. Suniva closed its doors several years ago. But while the sun set on this manufacturing company a while ago, it has risen again. Suniva recently announced plans to reopen a facility in Norcross, Georgia, that was idled in 2017, just before a bankruptcy filing. The company also closed a Michigan plant around the same time. About 6 years ago, the company petitioned the Trump administration to apply tariffs on foreign-made panels to reduce the flow of cheap competition. And while their wish was granted, it wasn't enough to get production back up and running. Then came the Inflation Reduction Act with subsidies for clean energy component makers that will provide the boost Suniva needs to operate. Customers who buy domestically produced solar cells can apply for a tax credit, and Suniva should get receive a major tax credit as well. According to Reuters, a domestic supply of solar cells wouldn't be possible without these incentives. Suniva's president, Matt Card, said the company has funding for a spring 2024 expansion that will create some 240 jobs. The company is also in advanced negotiations with a handful of big customers. Card says, quote, solar cells can succeed in this market. Well, Jeff, if both sides of the market are getting paid to participate, I would hope they could both succeed.
Yeah, I mean, for a government program, this makes a lot of sense, really shockingly almost.
Did it confuse you? You're just like, yeah, now hold the phone.
Yeah. A government program that actually did what it was supposed to do and benefited American companies. This is weird.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully this is a case study of sorts for other markets. You know, when you look into other renewable energy opportunities out there, really just innovative approaches to some of these challenges we face now. again, hopefully this is sort of a role model, a case study, whatever you want to say. When you look at some of these other sort of related markets, such as wind power, U.S. produces the second most amount of wind-based energy in the world. Yet when you look at the top 10 manufacturers of wind turbines, you have to get to number 10 before it's a U.S. company. And even then, it's a Chinese subsidiary. Mm. So hopefully this opens up new opportunities. Same thing with hydropower. U.S. is a leading producer of hydropower, but yet the only company in the top 20 that's a U.S. company making this type of equipment is General Electric. So again, if we can take this and sort of roll it out across some of these other industries, it seems like a pretty good case study on what can happen when you support U.S. manufacturing like this. Mm-hmm. This is a topic, if you look on our site, we've got Mike Collins. I know you guys are very familiar with him. He's written a couple of different books talking about how to support U.S. manufacturing. And a lot of this type of program is what he endorses, sort of putting not obstacles, but not making it so easy for foreign competitors to come in and displace U.S. manufacturers in a lot of these key and growing markets. And make no mistake, obviously, when we talk about renewable energy, this is a huge growth opportunity for U.S. manufacturing and all of the other different companies that go along with the supply chain. So supporting domestic production here, like you said, wins at a number of different fronts, and hopefully it keeps going.
Mike Collins is a manufacturing treasure, and I definitely recommend all of his columns. Just very insightful, and I enjoy reading them. Anna, it's not like solar couldn't use a boost right now.
I agree. This company is pretty interesting, too, because they were once considered the largest solar cell and panel manufacturer in the United States. And then, as you mentioned, they went bankrupt. And then since then, they've been considered dormant. That's the word that they use on their website, dormant.
Okay, they're just laying low.
I guess, yeah. I'm not sure exactly what that means. I know that they're a developer as well, not just a producer. So perhaps they're coming to the plate with some new, better processes, better functionality, better designs. I'm not sure. But they do have millions in funding to buy new equipment, so that's great. They have some external funding as well. It's not just like pivoting only on this government program. I know there's been a lot of talk about solar. People, I think, generally sometimes they have a bad taste in their mouth from Solyndra. Still.
It's crazy how tied to the solar market that tarnished brand is.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And just, people look at it like this is an industry that's not viable. And I disagree on that. I think I'd point to some of the ongoing efforts, by utilities to take a bite out of consumer solar energy production. They pay such low rates for the energy flowing back into the grid that it significantly will elongate the ROI for the buyer. Mm. And the result of that is it kneecaps the industry. So it's not like solar is operating already on a level playing field. I don't think that that's true. I think it's good to see someone come out on the side of solar and make those investments pay off a little bit quicker for the buyers, make it viable for those producers. And in a way, that's more straightforward and sensible, in my opinion, than tariffs on imports, which I think was a pretty knotted issue. There was a lot of conflict amongst solar panel makers on whether or not this was a good idea. It did move forward. It had some support, but the industry was kind of mixed on whether or not that was a good idea. It still exists to this day, in fact, but it's not to the level as it was when Trump's enacted that initially. But I do think that because of the parameters laid out in the IRA, we are seeing commercial users also take another look at solar. And in manufacturing and, distribution, all these companies, it's a lot to consider. It's expensive up front, but I mean, the thought of how quickly it can pay off with some of these incentives, you can be producing your own energy independently. That's huge, man. Like, that's something that I think, not just from an environmental perspective, but from an operating cost perspective, you're seeing more businesses kind of look at this again with renewed interest and say, actually, you know what, let's run those calculations again and see what we can do.
So when it comes to tariffs, I had a little bit of insight from John Fitzgerald Weaver, who's with PV or Photovoltaic Magazine. and it was striking to me. He says, quote, "We now have verification that solar module tariffs are morally, ethically, spiritually, physically, positively, absolutely, undeniably, and reliably dead." Suniva has announced plans to restart its solar cell manufacturing, and this announcement comes after years of the company's lobbying to restrict global solar panel imports into the U.S. Now, Suniva got its tariffs in February 2018, didn't resume production, as we said, and they didn't make any moves during the solar deployment boom of 2020 and 2021. So he mentions how this is an example of how the carrot is working much better than the stick. Following the Inflation Reduction Act, it's possible that the U.S. could become not just a big player, but like a solar tech exporter. And that was something that really stood out to me, just thinking that that could be that viable. Like, I was kind of reading it with the whole of, oh, right, we're going to make it just at least break even, you know, or at least everyone's going to make enough money to stay alive. But for them to actually be a competitive exporter, that's incredible. Weaver goes on to say, "The issue of the effectiveness of tariffs is stimulating manufacturing capacity appears to have a definitive answer." Want to guess what that answer is, Jeff? "They're not only merely dead, they're really most sincerely dead."
Oh, man, he's got a perspective on this. That's unwavering.
He does. Well, he certainly weaves a tale, and you know his where he stands on tariffs. But Jeff, would you agree with Weaver as to tariffs not working and it being better to use the carrot than the stick?
I think when it comes to this particular dynamic, yeah, the carrot is going to work better because you're building markets, as opposed to limiting sourcing, essentially. So yeah, it makes a lot more sense in this case to incentivize and build it up. You have to, you know, pick your analogy here, build the road before the car, the horse before the cart, whatever the case is.
Yeah.
All of those make sense here. And, you know, one of the things I want to talk about later on too, when we get to the sort of, in case you missed it, is a lot of the sort of the challenges we have around renewable energy. And it's not really the technology, it's the application and the input of it. And I think that's what this helps address in a pretty major way.
No, I think your "in case you missed it" ties into this subject really well. Anna, let's talk about Weaver not only as a poet, but, you know, what are your thoughts? I mean, you kind of brought it up as well, but it seems like, I mean, this is coming straight from the PV industry. And I mean, it seems like there's been quite a bit of poor taste in their mouth when it's come to tariffs for a long time.
There was a lot of backlash when this was originally introduced, and it was Suniva, and then there was another company, and I can't remember the name of it, but that company is also dead. I mean, that company
dormant.
Okay. it did not recover during that time period. And so, and at the time they were saying a lot of the competitors in this industry, US-based, were saying, this will just drive up the cost of these panels for consumers, and then you get, you know, people don't buy them. And so that's why it was so contentious. And I think that this legislation around the Inflation Reduction Act is, as you said, I think it just makes more sense.
All right. Our next most popular story was actually pretty wild because it was three stories together, combined together, all equally popular and all about the UAW's Big Three strike. So, an update. Last Wednesday night, 8,700 members left their jobs at Ford's Kentucky truck plant in Louisville, shutting down Ford's largest factory. The next day, union president Sean Fain hinted at further action against Stellantis, tweeting or Xing, "Here's to hoping talks at Stellantis today are more productive than Ford yesterday." In another statement, Fain said the union has waited long enough, quote, "but Ford hasn't gotten the message," to bargain for a fair contract. Ford called the strike expansion, quote, "grossly irresponsible," and put a network of some 100,000 employees at risk. The next day, Kumar Galhotra, then president of Ford Blue, the company's internal combustion engine business, and now new chief operating officer, said Ford stretched to get the offer it now has on the table, and that the company has reached its spending limit for a new contract. On Monday, Ford's executive chairman and Henry Ford's great-grandson, Bill Ford, called on auto workers to end the strike. He said that if they lose the ability to make future investments, quote, we will lose the competition. We will lose to the competition. America loses. Many jobs will be lost. The widening rift between the UAW and Ford suggests that we could be in for a lengthy strike that could cost the company and workers billions of dollars. Jeff, what are your thoughts on where the UAW strike stands with the big three?
I have so many thoughts, David. Let's just start knocking it off. If I start going too far down a rabbit hole here. The big thing that they keep going back to, even though there's a long list of different demands, is the pay, increasing the disparity there. I think the UAW, when you compound it over the four-year contract, is looking at something like a 46% pay increase. I think Ford is the highest, and they've come in at like 23%. There's still a huge gap.
Yeah.
Now, when you look at that 23%, I think it is a bit misleading. When you look at the more experienced worker, that's a sizable increase now. Mm-hmm. We don't know what's going to happen from an inflation perspective. We don't know what's going to happen from a job force perspective, especially in automotive with all this transition to EVs over the next 4 years. When you look at the entry-level worker, making on average about $18 an hour, that is not competitive. I think the UAW has a very strong case there in terms of seeing a more rapid increase or a higher percentage increase for entry-level workers, okay? So you can appreciate where they're coming from there. When you look at it from the automaker's perspective, it's been projected out that this would cost them somewhere around $5 billion, okay, annually to meet the UAW's demands. When you look at the fact that they had about 15 million per company, roughly, I'm using some baiting with some broad strokes here, in terms of net income, that takes a big chunk out of that when you are also looking to invest in EVs down the road, which could be tens of millions of dollars every year. So reading between the lines, I think this is completely about electric vehicle production down the road. And that's what's driving opinions and stances and people not wanting to cross a line and really dig in right now.
Yeah.
I think the UAW realizes that a lot of their members right now may not have a job in 10 years.
Yeah.
That job that they're fighting for right now may very well not be there. I think the automakers also want that to be the case. Mm-hmm. They have committed to making EVs and, again, investing all of this money. So when you're looking at these two dynamics that are really heading in the same direction but want to get there in a different way, that's what's causing all of this friction. And I think this is going to be a very lengthy standoff. I don't think this is going to get resolved anytime soon. I think it's not going to get real intense until the UAW starts running out of money in the fund. I think they're about halfway there now. I think they got about 11 weeks and they're at week five and a half, something like that. So it'll be interesting to see where that sort of break-even point comes, because I don't think they're going to get their 32-hour work week. I don't see a whole lot happening with pensions and things of that nature. Healthcare should always be met. I think that's a prominent and important worker need and demand that should be met and benefit that should be met. As far as pay, it'll be interesting to see where they come in, because I think the automakers are saying, we're not going to pay these guys a ton because they're a short-term solution. The UAW is saying, we need to get as much as we absolutely can right now because we don't know where these jobs are going in 10 years.
Yeah,
that seems to be why they're not mediating more on that publicly. I don't understand. Why don't they both come out and say, hey, look, we've got this big EV push. It's not just about investing in the technology. It's how we want to invest in our workers. Why doesn't the UAW say, we want some clarity on how you're going to train our current workforce to also handle some of this EV demand?
Mm-hmm.
Where I think the UAW needs to be very, very careful. And this was a quote that was actually from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Think about this. If every unemployed person with experience in durable goods manufacturing were employed today, manufacturing would fill only around 75% of vacant jobs. Mm-hmm. There is a workforce ready to step in here.
Oh, yeah.
So if the UAW lets this go too long and the automakers feel that they are losing out short-term and long-term,
but I mean, that's
this could get contentious.
But that's also a workforce that hasn't stepped in yet.
Correct.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is there's a pool of workers out there potentially to source, to come in and fill some of these roles. We've already seen them lay off almost 5,000 people.
Well, the layoffs in particular have been something that I've been keeping an eye on, Anna. We've seen a lot of furloughs at some of these smaller company, the smaller plants. We've seen a lot of furloughs and layoffs at suppliers. And to Jeff's point, do you think we're just seeing the beginning of this? Do you think we're at the midway point, or, you know, are we still digging in for kind of a long haul?
I do agree with Jeff that I think that we're not there yet. I think we could see a lot more time here. You know, we've talked about this on previous podcasts about when are the winds of the narrative going to shift where it applies the kind of pressure on the UAW to wrap this up before they start losing public support.
Well, and we have seen articles coming out now that it's been 5 weeks, public support and not public support, but support within the UAW's ranks perhaps might be waning.
I don't know if that's accurate, actually, because
I want to circle back to that. That's an interesting point.
I looked at that because I was also curious, you know, what does the public think about what's happening right now? Whose side are they on? Ford, in one of these articles, one of the execs at Ford tried to make a point about just sort of slid in that, like, they make emergency response vehicles and this is impacting, you know, you can tell that wherever they can, they're trying to get that message in, maybe to get people on their side of look how.
What about law enforcement?
Right. I know. Look how selfish these workers are being. We need these vehicles to be produced or, you know, no one can get in an ambulance, whatever. Yeah. Right now, still, there's a lot more support lying with the UAW than I expected. So in a poll that was cited profusely this week, because I saw this in quite a few areas, it was an AP NORC Center for Public Affairs Research poll. It revealed that 36% of Americans sympathize with the workers in their dispute with the automakers and 9% support the automakers. That last remaining chunk, which is more than half, is reportedly folks who support neither or both.
so it hasn't affected me yet, so I don't care.
Right,
have an opinion.
Exactly. Yeah. Indifference, I will. Anyway, but either way, I think it's potentially evidence that, you know, with fewer than 10% of people polled saying they are fully behind these companies, that there is a lot more rope here. And the pressure on the UAW, who has this big strike fund to boot, I just don't think it's gotten to that point of intensity yet. I think we have a lot of time before we get there. They can wait a while. And the UAW, by the way, they said that their support is 4 out of 5 Americans. So I take it with a grain of salt, but all the while, considering that union perception is still pretty strong right now, it spiked in 2022 when Gallup said that 71% of Americans approved of unions. This year, it's at 67%. That's still very high.
Yeah. So what I was talking about was that there is fatigue among people that are striking
within the unions. And I do think that maybe that goes quicker because their strike pay is abysmal. I mean, that's terrible. So I could see them people kind of losing motivation there. If Sean Fain is the leader that he seems to think that he is, I don't know if that's true, if he's like, if he's getting people on board with his messaging, but he's got a lot of work to do to maintain that enthusiasm for the strike, right?
Yeah, because other than these little breadcrumbs that you get along the way in terms of like victories and setbacks, it's like monotonous, you know? Yeah. You're just out there on the line, not doing anything. Mm-hmm. And that has to take a toll on you mentally.
I agree 100%. I think one of Fain's goals too was to sort of get a little bit more attention or wake up some of these other auto plants that are non-union right now.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's been interesting for me to gauge. Just looking at some of the different reporting, it seems very split. There's a lot of people who are looking at these UAW strikes down in Mississippi and Georgia and South Carolina going, you know, if they get something out of this, maybe we should look at it again. And then you've also got half of those individuals going, there's no way I'd want to deal with that right now. Mm-hmm. I'm very happy with the fact that I can come here and I've gotten raises and everything's worked out well for me. So it's interesting to see that perception. I think it's very polarizing in terms of when you look at some of these survey results. I'd like to see more of the demographic breakdown of who is responding to some of these surveys. Because I think when you ask any general individual, hey, should somebody get paid more? Yeah, of course. We all want somebody to get paid more. I think that's different when you put it in the context of a strike and what people's relation to that is. You know, one of the things the article brought up were all those members of MEMA who have also, those companies had experienced layoffs. probably not a lot of fans of UAW there if you're one of those individuals who works at a supplier to Ford or GM or Stellantis. And right now you're sitting at home too because there's no work being done.
Yeah.
One thing I did want to qualify too, when you talk about that U.S. Chamber of Commerce stat that I threw out there, I do appreciate the fact that these individuals may not have any experience that's equivalent to those who are striking right now.
Yeah.
Don't want to discount that in terms of the value that they bring.
Yeah.
Just pointing out there, other thing is these UAW folks may have someplace else that they can go to.
Yeah.
So you wonder how that's going to impact people over time.
I mean, that's one thing that I think about often is that, you know, you do have the protections of the UAW, but I mean, manufacturing skills are like at a premium right now. And I mean, I just know anecdotally what the people in the manufacturing sphere around me are like experiencing in terms of people that are kind of bidding for their talents, that it's out there. You know, it might not be where you live, but, you know, I guess maybe that's something that as you're striking, you can kind of have in your back pocket and be like, okay, I know that my skill set is still highly in demand.
Very relevant. Yeah, very true.
One thing I'm going to ask is if Dan, who's watching us live, could just give us a little bit more context on his comment. I want to read it, but 100%, I'm not 100% on what it means, Dan. So just give me a little bit more context there. One thing I wanted to add was on Galhotra, the new COO. He called Ford's offer, quote, incredibly positive, and said Ford never indicated to the union that it would be increased. So he's kind of just like, hey, we kind of told him this is it. Like
he did say something strange though, like, well, the dollars are the dollars, but we can move some money around.
He did like, say that.
What is that?
No, it was, so he said, we have been very clear, we are at a limit. We risk the ability to invest in the business and profitably grow, and profitable growth is in the best interest of everybody at Ford. He is still, however, optimistic that both sides can reach a deal. And you're right. Then he had the comment where he's just like, well, we're gonna move things around. You know, what is that?
Take some money out of petty cash.
Yeah, that's confusing though. That's a mixed message.
So, Jeff, to your point on MEMA, a survey of the parts supply companies that are a part of this trade association, which is for vehicle suppliers, found that 30% of members have already laid off workers, and that more than 60% expect to start layoffs now.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. You know, the automotive aftermarket has their big shows at the end of the month here. It's always usually the last week of October, first week of November. You're looking at Apex and SEMA. It's going to be interesting to see what kind of impacts or sort of what the tone is out at that show.
Yeah.
Yeah. Didn't Stellantis just pull out of SEMA?
They pulled out of CES.
Oh, CES. Yeah. And because they got too much going on.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like, we were going to show you what we're going to do, but we might not be able to make it. So nah, we have larger fish to fry than the lighting for our big booth.
Fair enough.
Yeah. All right. Our next most popular story this week.
Do you think
they
got the deposit for their booth back?
I don't think so.
They're going to have to eat that.
I don't think so.
The electrical costs.
That's what's going to come up in negotiations. And now we have all these CES costs. Like, we've already started shipping things.
Yeah.
Which, those costs for trade show logistics, obscene.
Yeah.
Just obscene.
Especially that show.
And anyone in the industry that deals with any trade show, we just commiserate with you. We understand it's like, what is it? Like a necessary burden. Yeah. All right. Our next most popular story this week. Lordstown's former CEO buys company's remains in bankruptcy bid. Lordstown Motors is back, baby. Maybe. According to a SEC filing, when Lordstown began Chapter 11 proceedings in June, the bankruptcy court approved bidding procedures to sell off the company's assets. The sellers received a qualifying bid from one LAS Capital. The company has no affiliation with Lordstown Motors, but it was founded by Lordstown's founder and former CEO, Steve Burns. Former Lordstown CFO Julio Rodriguez is also reportedly in the mix. The next step will be whether or not the bankruptcy court approves the purchase, which it just did. Burns and Rodriguez resigned in June 2021 after Lordstown's board investigated allegations that Burns and other executives lied about $1.4 billion in pre-orders for the company's electric pickup truck, the Endurance. It is unclear exactly what LAS and the former Lordstown founder is trying to buy, what they're going to do with it. So, Anna, speculate.
Ugh. You, like, cannot make this up. This is just like so ridiculous.
Yeah, instead of the like snowball that started rolling downhill, it's just the endurance that continues to roll downhill.
Yeah, I know. It just there's no motor in it. You just
yeah, just and like there's an no motor, no brakes.
Empty vessel.
It's coming.
If you're wondering where Steve Burns got the money, he got it from Lordstown. Despite leaving in disgrace, he cashed out about $60 million in stock before he left, including what was reported as a large sell-off in the days leading up to the company filing bankruptcy, which I'm sure was above board and totally unrelated to that.
Yeah, he just needed a little spending
He's
money.
Read the tea leaves.
Yeah, he just, you know, okay. So will this be a boost to a business that is basically rudderless right now? Not according to Sam Abuelasmeed, a principal analyst for Guidehouse Insights, who told FreightWaves earlier this week that Lordstown is just as doomed as ever. Adding, quote, I have no more confidence that Lordstown will gain any market traction than it did yesterday. So the analysts don't see Burns as the savior Lordstown needs. And I have to say, I agree with that. I think, you know, the Foxconn deal was a disaster, but the only reason that they were there was because they were already on life support. And much of that had to do with what, you know, decisions that Burns and Rodriguez made when they decided to inflate those orders and otherwise orchestrate what turned out to be really like a smoke and mirrors show that, you know, helped lead to lawsuits. It led to this mass exodus of investors, their stock plummeting, all that stuff. So if the leadership is tenuous, and there's no trust from investors, and Burns also, by the way, doesn't own the factory or really the Endurance for that matter, because Foxconn has a contract to produce that vehicle. There's not that much here. Yeah. I don't know what, you know, I don't know what they're buying exactly either. It's very confusing because of how much Foxconn has the right to right now. It seems like a fool's errand to me, like some score to settle or you're trying to prove a point in some way like that. No, I got this.
Yeah.
I don't think they got this.
Well, it is anyone that's been forced out at a company, especially one that they helped found or something like that. This is the pipe dream, right? Where it's just like, oh, I'll get you back.
And he can't.
I'll get you back.
He can't see clearly because of that, I think.
True. But I mean, he might have a bargain on his hands depending on it. And Jeff, before we go to you, like right before we started recording the podcast, like news broke about a little bit more information about what was all involved. So I was going to get into that if that's okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So the deal was just approved. Founder Steve Burns bought the remains for $10 million, right? After having the highest and best bid. Also, maybe the only.
I know, that was my first thought.
Yeah, no, the asset auction, it's so crazy, right? Where like it has to be a qualified bid. It has to be an approved bid. So it has to be like enough. So you can't like really just be like a dollar. Mm-hmm. It's a crazy process. Anyway, among the assets to be purchased are the design, production, and sale of vehicles produced by the plant. He's buying the equipment, right? Most of the purchased equipment is located at the Ohio manufacturing facility that is now owned by Foxconn. And now LAS Capital has got to work with Foxconn to remove all the machinery. He's not buying any of the trucks. But Jeff, do you think maybe he still believes, or do you just think he knows that there's more than $10 million in inventory and he could liquidate it for...
Okay, so the part that I'm confused, did he get the intellectual property? Because that was initially, it wasn't as clear, but when I hear about the design that he can purchase, that means intellectual property.
Yes, okay. I believe that's right.
So I think maybe, okay, Lordstown in terms of a company name or whatever you want to say, I do believe that is, like Anna said, that's done.
Done. Yeah.
However he wants to repackage it, whatever he wants to call it, I don't think this truck is dead.
Yeah,
but how does he? He does not
I'm
have.
I'm getting
the,
there.
Okay, all right. All right.
Give me a minute.
All right. Jeff. All right. Jeff,
I mean, you
Jeff,
think
Jeff.
We're talking about flying taxis or something here?
Yeah, Jeff. No, Jeff, I mean, you have the floor.
At some point, flying taxis are much more realistic than the insurance.
The only more disgusted Anna could have been is if we were talking about another flying car.
I don't know.
Get it out of my face.
A flying electric Endurance coming soon to roadways.
So if he does indeed have the IP to build an electric truck. This seems to be what he is trying to do. Burns is trying to do with this LAS Capital Group. If you look on their site, now I don't know how successful this stuff is, okay? But he's looking at Green Street.
Yeah.
That is an electric three-wheel vehicle. that he seems very confident is going to start production in 2024. Same thing with, what's this other one? This boat. I forget the name of it here.
Nope, not it is that. A flying car.
There is one flying one. But the one that actually was viable, I think it's called Big Motors.
This is going to succeed.
Blue Innovations Group, BIG. So basically they've got an electric boat that they're also looking to produce.
So hold on a second.
In the next 12 months.
He has an electric boat, a flying car, and now the Endurance. That's a portfolio.
And a three-wheeler.
And an electric three-wheeler.
Now, all they do with this LAS Capital, they're just providing the money. They're just the money guy. They've worked with somebody who had the idea. It's got production in place, all of that.
They just need a hovercraft.
This IP, I'm telling you, he's taking this IP. He's got a connection. He's got some sort of contract manufacturer lined up. You're going to see the Endurance or whatever they're going to call it. Mm-hmm. Again, from LAS Capital, I guarantee you he's got a manufacturer in place to start working with the IP that he bought.
He has a compelling pitch. Just like, we were almost there. I just bought all the equipment. We have the exact process. Yeah. We just got to pull it. We got to get the keys to the facility. We pull it out, install it, and you're 90% of the way to an electric truck.
Now, the other thing I'll say, Anna, before you just bury this, is I'm not saying it's a good idea. Okay. I mean, we've already seen the Lightning, very popular. It's got some issues to work through. Chevy's still working, or GMC is still working on bringing out the Silverado. Canoe's got their version of a truck. Fisker's got their, I don't know if it's a prototype, concept, whatever you want to call the Alaska, they've got a form of a truck. Tesla's been talking about the Cybertruck forever. So my point is, by the time he would actually get this made, probably way too late.
Bananas competition.
So I'm just trying to maybe crawl inside his head a little bit. I think that's what he's thinking about. He got a deal in terms of all the production assets, the IP, how to make it. He's got all the ingredients for the sandwich. Just got to find a place to put it together. I think it's going to be too late, but it's an interesting process.
Anna?
I don't know all the nuts and bolts behind this deal, but if you consider the fact that Foxconn has a contractual right to produce the Endurance, that was part of their deal, that has not changed. Even if he buys the IP for it, like they have to make, I would assume, some very significant changes to the design, or he's in breach
10%.
In breach of that deal.
Yeah, he's got to tweak the headlamps.
It's 10%?
I think it's 10% for IP. I'm going to be wrong, but I think it's got to be 10% different, so that way it's not infringing on the IP.
All right. So he's got that. He's got soft tooling, I would guess. I mean, I don't, So I don't think he's, secondly, this vehicle is, there's no one's going to buy it. Like there's no, I think when you look at what he has, and maybe he can rebrand to the point where people forget about this and they don't remember, but the Lordstown brand is so tarnished at this point that to even be associated with it, would you trust that IP? I don't think people, because of the brand has been through so much, I would never go near that.
What if they put out, David, something like 100 trucks?
Yeah.
And they're already subject to a recall?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, they're all recalled. That's why he didn't buy the trucks, because they're already recalled and all the physical trucks are facing all kinds of lawsuits. So he didn't want to touch that. But it won't be the Endurance. It'll be something else. And I don't think people are going to look further beyond LAS Capital. And, unless they read to the seventh or eighth paragraph of the story, they're not going to know that this is the Lordstown legacy.
Unless, because it was such a clown show, the media makes that very clear when that brand comes back out, which is possible.
Plus, are you guys seeing a lot more Rivians on the road?
Yes. Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
They look good, too.
They look so cool, and they're so expensive, and I want one, but they look, awesome.
No, I will say,
I'm glad Anna could come back around. All right, she's in a better mood.
It's one that continues to turn my head every time I see it, and I know it's a Rivian by the time I've done this, the double take, where I'm just like, oh, man. Yeah. So, about LAS Capital's flying car.
The Rise.
The Rise. It is planned to be the first manned eVTOL for sale in the U.S. You're not going to need FAA approval or a pilot's license.
Cool. Why would we want those things for somebody who's in a hovering vehicle?
It has six
props. Just a bunch of Uber drivers just sign up and they can just do it?
Essentially, you're in a drone that carries a person. It's a hexacopter with six props. There have been over 200 public test flights to date, which I don't think sounds like a lot. Mm-hmm. I want more than 200 before I get into it. And it's the first to fly at CES 2023 this year. They're going to start production next year. So we don't even need to worry about the Endurance in their life because
what could go wrong?
Rise is going to be printing the money for LAS Capital.
I love no FAA approval.
Yeah.
Like, oh, good. Okay. Yeah. Do they even know we're in the air? Cool. Yeah. Like,
it's like when you were a kid and you found out that you could like ride in a go-kart or, you know, without a license. And you're just like, what do you mean? Like, I just get in and turn on. I can go wherever I want.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just lawless. Lawless.
Did they say it's got like a fuzz buster in there? So it'll just like no radar can catch you in this thing either.
Oh, it's
cops can't find me.
I did like, I mean, it looked like just looking at some of the rudimentary safety features, it looks like you can land on like a airbag that's underneath it, that deploys underneath it.
I'm sold.
Which is good.
I'll take two.
Yeah.
Seems all right.
I'm into it. I just got to figure out how I get my baby seats on the hood. All right. Our next most popular story this week. Fourth generation shop to close if buyer falls through. In late September, Superior Die Set Corporation, a fourth generation family-owned maker of steel and aluminum products, told the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development it was closing the company's plant in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. According to Superior Die, the move comes as a result of decreased order volume. The layoffs could happen soon. By November 20th, 133 employees might be out of work. The company has been around since 1923 and now operates out of a 150,000 square foot facility. But there is some hope. According to the company, it is working with a strategic buyer to take over operations in Oak Creek, and an agreement could soon be finalized. While Superior Die is still taking other offers, the potential buyer reportedly has the expertise and resources to keep the doors open. Andrew Chadwick, Global Director of Safety and Human Resources, said it was a, quote, difficult decision, but there was work to be done regardless of future events, and the company appreciates, quote, everyone's continued focus. The potential deal and closure won't include Superior's two European facilities. Now, Anna, a couple of things in this really stood out to me. One was the, we appreciate everyone's continued focus. Everything's going to be fine. Everything's going to be fine, but we appreciate your continued focus. And the other was, oh, we got a buyer lined up. Everything's going to be fine. I mean, we're still taking other offers, but everything's going to be fine. We got a buyer lined up. So everything should be fine, right?
Yeah, to me, it seemed more like this was about maybe remaining compliant and avoiding any potential fines that could come out of this falling through rather than potentially like a real threat to the viability of the business. I say that because they filed the WARN notice despite having been already working with a strategic buyer exclusively, which leads me to believe that this is likely but not a done deal. Mm-hmm. They did say, the wording that I took from that wording, not that they were like entertaining other offers, but they had gotten other offers. Okay. And that this offer was the one that they were pursuing currently because it was the best fit. So I think maybe they have backup interested parties, but their fear is that something might collapse and then the primary buyer moves.
Keep the doors open.
Yeah, like they have to shutter while they pursue other options, maybe.
Yeah.
Which is a very unfortunate scenario to have to display publicly. Yeah. Because you know, in this case, normally I think a business is like doing this behind the scenes and then they just get it done. They're not like at the brink when they're working through this to the point where they're like, okay, if this doesn't work out and we have to go back to the drawing board, we cannot operate. The quote that they had on their website said, while this is a possibility, our focus and efforts are on transferring ownership to the above mentioned buyer and continuing the current operations. We will continue our commitment to doing what is best for our customers, employees, and stakeholders. So it's sort of a shame, I think, to consider that a lot of companies are doing this under the radar and they're having to make public statements that are tantamount to like, we are borderline insolvent.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a good look. And I think like if you're an existing customer to this business, you're maybe looking for other suppliers because you don't know what's going to happen. It would have been great if this was in the works prior. It just seemed like, I don't know obviously what happened internally, but it seems to me like this is too late in the process, and then they're having to put in this war notice because they don't know for sure.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, that's too bad. I wish it would have happened months ago, and then, you know, and it doesn't sound like they're getting support from corporate really either to like at least let this function while it's, you know, in transition, which is unfortunate for the brand because the brand still operates, as you said, in other, you know, they have two other plants.
Yeah. Both in Poland, I believe. Mm-hmm. So there was a little bit more context around this that was covered by the Milwaukee Business Journal. And Jeff, again, I'm going to step in again just because I know I want you to comment on this too. So company co-chairman Frank Genesiewski, and that is my best effort, having grown up with a bunch of Ooskies in the southeastern Wisconsin. How do I mean, obviously, I didn't get it right if I can't see southeastern. So Frank Genesiewski told the Milwaukee Business Journal that the company has to sell the Oak Creek facility or has been planning to sell it for years. He says that the tooling market, primarily in automotive, has been declining and isn't expected to improve until 2024. That was something that stood out to me as well. Like, hey, we expect it to get better. Just not that soon. And I was like, oh, it has to be further down the road. And it's like, no, next year, which again, it starts in like 3 months.
Yeah.
The sale, he said about the sale, it's up to the buyers. It's an option that's on the table. And that was a direct quote. So I was thinking it likely comes down to price, right? Is it worth buying everything now when it's up and running, or wait for Superior to walk away, which, you know, it just kind of set a deadline of November 20th plus 14 days. I don't know. So I that was very curious to me. A little bit more context. Yeah. The news of the closure came shortly after it was confirmed that Frank Genesiewski and his wife Pamela had entered a Chapter 11 reorganization plan for personal bankruptcy.
Oof.
Frank told the Milwaukee Business Journal, there is no link between my personal situation and the company situation, which he says, again, has been in the mix for years. The company, or this bankruptcy, comes after the bank foreclosed on the couple's investment, or the couple's Rolling Hills Country Club. So a few more wrinkles there where, Jeff, he says it's been in the mix for years, but there are just a couple of things lining up that make it seem like maybe it was a bit more forced.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. You know, first of all, just kind of going back, if you look at the timeline on this company, really interesting in terms of how they survived the Great Depression, the role they played during World War II, in terms of supplying for the military and the war effort and everything like that, and how they have been able to keep it in the family basically for the last, I think, for the first 95 years, the company was functional. So there's a lot of things that sort of came to my mind, and it's all speculative. I mean, some of this definitely adds some context to it, some additional context.
Yeah.
You do wonder with things ramping up with the UAW strike, with things slowing down in the automotive sector, if that is a big part of their market, you could definitely see that having an impact in terms of a buyer coming in and saying, yeah, I'm ready. Maybe they were thinking one thing a month ago and they're thinking something differently now, if that's a big part of their customer base. Mm-hmm. The other thing I was wondering, just in how long it's taking and some of the other dynamics involved with this, maybe they're trying to sell it to employees. And if that's the case, that could just take longer.
Yeah.
And trying to at least keep employees in the loop. The other thing I was thinking about, and maybe I'm watching too much professional wrestling right now, like maybe they're trying to set up this new buyer to come in and look like a huge hero. Oh. In other words, you know, coming in at the last minute, like we didn't know if it could work. We did it. We're buying it. We're keeping everybody on board. But you know, in order to do that, we're going to have you guys, you know, take a little pay cut. We're going to need some tax breaks. We're going to need all of these other things potentially to make this work. So or it's going to go away.
It's already a two count and they're about to kick out.
Yeah, something like that. So there's a lot of different things you could look at, with understanding now, too, that the president's or one of the owner's financial situation is a bit dire. Mm-hmm. If you're the buyer, you probably are going to leverage that a bit and see what the absolute best price you can get.
Yeah. Anna, it's crazy to me that this company that has lasted 100 years, survived the Great Depression, and many other market dynamics could be undone by a bad country club investment.
Well, again, we don't know that for sure, that there's a link there. I mean, they're saying that there isn't. We don't know.
They're saying that there isn't, but their assets, they backed the loans with their personal assets.
Ah.
Yeah.
Then how could there not be a link?
Because they said there's no link. It's just saying it's looking like a link.
It is unfortunate. This is a lot of jobs. This is a longstanding business, a longstanding family business, and in a community that you know, would suffer from the loss. So I'm hopeful that this works out. I'm hopeful, as I said before, that they're just trying to like check some boxes meanwhile, because it's not a done deal, but they're really hopeful that it will be, just to make sure that they don't get into a regulatory quagmire with the WARN notice, because that's an expensive fine, right?
Yeah.
So hopefully it works out in the end. That's what I'm hoping.
No, Jeff, I didn't even think of the idea about selling it to the employees. That'd be a great scenario. And I mean, I feel like in this particular part of the country, in this particular part of Wisconsin, it is a hub for these types of shops. And, mm-hmm. you know, I feel like there could be good fits out there outside of whatever the current buyer is. Yeah. But I don't know. That's just optimistic thinking. All right. Our next most popular story this week, our absolute number one with the bullet top story this week, Yuengling wants in on Bud Light fallout. The beer rush caused by the fallout from the Bud Light fiasco has been an opportunity for other brewers. DG Yuengling and Son continues to sell out, and it's now America's fourth fastest growing beer brand. According to a new report from the New York Post, sales have spiked 22% for the company through early last month, and that's with distribution in only half of the country. Yuengling is only sold in 26 states. This explosive growth has led to logistical problems for the nearly 200-year-old beer maker that's based out of Pottsville, Pennsylvania. According to the Post, larger brands are trying to poach Yuengling's shelf space, prompting the company's fifth-generation president, Dick Yuengling, to say that he just wants his, quote, fair share of the Bud Light debacle. The company is struggling with distributors who aren't restocking shelves fast enough and trying to force price increases. And stores haven't ceded shelf space. While Anheuser-Busch may be down, they are certainly not out. And the giant is using the full weight of the company's resources to offer deep discounts and rebates in an effort to maintain market position and keep that shelf space. Yuengling has the potential to grow. The company says it could make 500,000 more barrels of beer next year if retailers and distributors would just give them a chance. Anna, could this grow? Could this possibly be, I don't want to say a blessing in disguise, but the fact that they're clearly making big gains in the market, and without all of a sudden, like maybe these restrictions are making it so they don't grow too fast or suffer from scale problems?
I mean, I think that scale is a massive challenge right now for Yuengling. And, you know, for Dick Yuengling, you know, he's doing what any competitive beer maker would do. He would want to exploit a gap in the market. He's just saying the quiet part out loud.
Yeah.
that makes sense from a business perspective, right? That's what they would want. But to me, this story has a lot less to do with Bud Light and more to do with supply chain issues and scale issues that Yuengling is experiencing. So, you know, we're in an economy where labor is scarce, materials and packaging materials also scarce, especially in the beer industry. We've learned that multiple times about packaging problems, hop shortages, all kinds of stuff that they're dealing with. Mm-hmm. So it's not as simple as just rising to meet demand. I know demand is very high for this beer right now, but you said they're only in 26 states. They were only in 22 states like 2 years ago.
Yeah.
They're doing this massive. So in 2020, they partnered with Molson Coors mm-hmm. to try to spread their distribution out across the country. So they were an East Coast brand. There was demand, they believed, for their product across the country. So they kind of started to move into the Midwest in the last 2 years. They moved into Texas. It's been a very aggressive expansion. And in early 2023, after they had moved into three new Midwestern states, they immediately began to run into supply problems. According to the industry site Brewbound, they said that they were going to try to catch up in the next couple of months. This was in February. Mm. We know stockouts are really, you know, not uncommon, I would say, in the beer industry for a variety of reasons. But you know, it stands to reason to me that they were kind of caught flat-footed, maybe, as this Bud Light thing started to unfold. They were already at a disadvantage because they're already trying to scale. Yeah. Demand's already going up. They're already trying to distribute in areas that they didn't do so before. So as they, you know, they also have like a expansion project that they undertook in 2020 in Florida. They added a hotel, a restaurant to their brewery location. And they just have a lot going on. Now they're trying to ship beer from Pennsylvania to Texas, basically.
Yeah.
So I do think that they're trying to fit a lot of growth into a relatively short time period. And this scenario is clearly just Yuengling venting over what looks to me like merchandising challenges.
Yeah.
You know, like, what do these stores do if they don't receive this product consistently? Leave the shelves empty until it gets there? They're not going to do that. Like, that's not how this works.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, like, Yuengling has to, I don't know, they have to work their way into some of these markets maybe that they're not in already. And that's just like the cost of doing business. That's how the beer industry works.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, I'm sure they're frustrated by it, but at the same time, like, you can't fill a gap that's of market share that's being given up by a competitor and also expand in such a precipitous way at the exact same time amid a labor shortage, amid supply shortages, you know, it's just amid trucker shortages, and you're transporting product across the country. Like, there's just a lot to deal with there, and there's a lot of challenges for them.
Well, and I think these, like you said, these are already challenges that they would have had completely void of the Bud Light fiasco, right? But that certainly gives you a hot button issue to kind of jump onto and get your message out there. Now, when Anna talks about the demand for this, Jeff, it is wild, because being in a Yuengling prohibitive state of Wisconsin, we actually saw Yuengling come up just multiple times in my own circle. 2 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago at softball, we're sitting on the bench, or we're sitting in the bleachers watching the next game. And all of a sudden, podcast contributor Andy Zell shouts at a man on the other side of the bleachers, Is that a Yuengling? And just, I'm like, and he saw it from, the beer was in a koozie. He saw the like quarter inch ring on top, and he knew it was a Yuengling. And he was just like, he did everything he could except ask for one. And then that following weekend, we're up north taking the pier out, and my brother's drinking a Yuengling. I'm like, whoa, how'd you get your hands on that? It's such a hot commodity. He's like, when we were driving through Kansas, we stopped everywhere that sold beer, and we bought whatever they had. And I was like, ha, that is hilarious. He's like, we really did that. So I had no idea the demand was there. So they obviously could, you know, harness this demand and move into other states. But I don't know if they just can logistically right now.
I was also unaware of this demand. I've had Yuengling before. It's solid. I don't know.
Yeah,
I guess I did not appreciate the zeal for that brand. What's interesting is they can actually sell it in Wisconsin now through Molson Coors. I think maybe that may be part of what Yuengling's frustration is. They signed this big deal, and maybe it's not happening fast enough for them. So they're trying to pressure one of their big distributors here. I think it's tough, and I can appreciate where they're coming from in terms of, hey, people want my stuff, sell more of it. I think we've heard this with numerous suppliers working with distributors over the years. Mm-hmm. It's always been an ongoing battle, but when you look in that retail environment, it's always been a pay-to-play, and it's always been a long-term versus short-term game. So there's no way that these distributors and retailers are going to pick Yuengling over Budweiser. There's just no way that's going to happen. Not when you've got a company with all the resources, all the advertising, all the merchandising, everything they do to draw people to their products. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're not just talking about Bud Light here. We're talking about Busch Light. We're talking about Budweiser and some of these other brands that haven't seen the same reaction or lack of demand for their product. Mm-hmm. So I think you do need, I understand the frustration, but I also get where some of these retailers are coming from. At the same time, I know you have a limited amount of shelf space and all of those things, but boy, when you look at some of those numbers you pointed out, which mm-hmm. I was not aware of in terms of the growth.
Yeah.
I don't know. I might find an extra shelf I could throw up someplace and put some of this stuff on it if I can get it. Okay.
Yeah.
I understand that's a big issue, but they might be missing out on a big opportunity here too. So I think his approach, you know, Anna said, these are the things people don't say out loud.
Yeah.
Hey, shake some trees. You never know.
Well, and I mean, obviously, part of it has to be that he's just not playing the distributor's game right now, right? Yeah. He mentions that they came and said, hey, you need to charge more for this. He says, no, that's not who we are. And when the person that's, you know, or the people that are in charge of getting it to the shelf aren't happy with your business model, I mean, it's not that surprising that it doesn't make it to the shelf.
Yeah.
So industry analyst Bump Williams told the Post, quote, Yuengling is largely out of stock in the markets it's available in and deserves more distribution and shelf space because consumer demand is higher today than what retailers have given them. Thanks, Bump. Again, I'm not concerned about Yuengling just because of its organic growth. Hopefully he doesn't get, they don't get too big for their britches, so to speak, you know, based on what he thinks he should have versus what he actually has right now. And so I don't know that this is necessarily the worst thing for them. There's something to be said about, a steady paced organic growth.
Well, and it's hard to know if you look at like these individual point of sale, locations, you know, a lot of this growth is likely coming from these completely new markets that were not being tracked before.
Right.
So like you're adding the state of Texas, like you're probably selling more beer.
Yeah.
But at an individual storefront in, you know, Indiana, maybe it's a 1% bump.
Yeah.
You know, it's like very hard to know how that shakes out across portfolio. I do believe that if it was flying off the shelves, literally, that they would get more shelf space.
Yeah. As long as they can get it there.
As long as they can get it there.
Yeah. Got to get it on the truck, guys.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Before we move on to, in case you missed it, the stories that maybe weren't as popular this week, but still stand a big impact on our industry going forward, we have another word from Rockwell Automation. This week's episode is brought to you by Rockwell Automation, which wants to help you gain unlimited HMI visualization options. This new video podcast, now available on demand, highlights Rockwell's recent rollout of Factory Talk Optics, a new cloud-enabled HMI product. According to the company, this latest offering centers on improving processes, efficiency, and deliverables by providing new levels of collaboration, scalability, and interoperability. Download the podcast now. There should be a link in the live chat, and there is a link in the body. Click it now. We will pause. Thank you for clicking. All right. Let's move on to, in case you missed it, again, stories not as popular on the site, but still stand to make a big impact on the industry going forward. Anna, you have to go first because of the story you chose.
I have to.
You have to go first.
All right. Well, that's a lot of pressure.
I mean, it's a great story.
Okay. the story I chose is titled Tyson Acquires Stake in Insect Ingredients Company, which I am surprised did not get more traffic because when I saw that, I was like very intrigued.
It boggles my mind.
Yes. So here's what's happening. Tyson Foods, which is, of course, one of the largest food companies in the world, has reached an agreement for a twofold investment in Protix, which is the leading global insect ingredients company. The strategic investment will support the growth of the emerging insect ingredient industry and expand the use of insect ingredient solutions to create more efficient, sustainable proteins and lipids for use in the global food system. The agreement combines Tyson Foods' global scale, experience, and network with Protix's technology and market leadership to meet current market demand and scale production of insect ingredients. So what is current market demand, you may ask? the edible insect market now stands at about $3 billion globally, but it is expected to more than double in the next 5 years.
Yeah.
I learned.
Weird. It's weird.
I learned just today that there is a term, entotarian, for a person whose diet includes insects but no other meat products.
An entotarian? That's enough to have, like, there are enough people to have an actual, like,
there's a word.
Term?
Yep.
I mean, is it just the one person that came up with it?
So if you want to be, like, the most annoying person at the restaurant, you should ask them if they have an entotarian menu.
What are your entotarian options? And then they're going to come
can
out
that
with
be
like
made entotarian?
Yeah, like a beetle meatball, and you're just stuck. You're in it. Just like, well, you got to have it now.
Yeah, they made it. Anyway, it was interesting because it's a fast-growing market, especially in Southeast Asia. And right now, it looks like Europe basically dominates this industry. It's highly fragmented. So I think it's sort of ripe for a big company like Tyson to come in and try to make a play for some of this business. I know it's weird, but it makes sense kind of when you look at the data around it. So somebody has to jump in and try to make a play.
Yeah, it's a weird, sad reality.
Well, I don't know about...
Okay, not a sad reality.
I don't know if I would say
sad reality.
Yeah.
But like it's what was normally painted as like a dystopian future just coming to fruition.
Oh, of people eating bugs?
Yeah.
But like, look at what they're doing. They're not just like making beetle meatballs. They're also talking about lipids. So like trying to find different types of fat to use as an ingredient in other foods.
Yes.
It's more sustainable. I understand that. The way that we're careening towards the future with the factory farming and the meat industry is not sustainable. It's not going to feed the world continuously forever. So I get it that this is something that people need to explore.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I know that, you know, you think about crickets a lot when you think about edible insects. That's where mine goes immediately. But guess which insect has the highest market share in the edible bug category with 31%?
Larva.
Mealworms.
It is the beetle.
Oh!
Isn't that...
More bang for your buck with the beetle.
So nasty to think about. And then, okay, so followed by caterpillars with 17%. And then with 15% is the category that includes... ants, bees, and wasps. What is that about?
I'm not against, we've talked about it on the podcast. I was intrigued enough to get a pouch of dehydrated bugs and, a bug Chex Mix, if you will.
Yeah.
And try it out. We got to work on the flavor profile a little bit because it is just, you know, like eating dirt. one thing that stood out to me was that with this release and with the news is that to me, Tyson really tried to pitch it as like animal feed or other areas of feed, like the food supply chain that it's going to fit in, not human.
That's where it starts, David, though.
But yeah, no, that's where it starts. And if you go to Protix's website, that is not the same messaging. Mm-hmm. That is not the same messaging. In a video, Aman Paul, who is the director of product R&, because they forgot to put the D on there, he says, quote, "The population growth is evident. We will become 9 billion people by 2050. So we need to produce ingredients that are highly efficient, which can provide nutrition to people without taking up a lot of space, without taking a lot of resources, which are highly sustainable." People food, Jeff.
Mm-hmm.
People food.
I'll eat it, just like grind it up and put it into a patty so I don't have to like realize what it is.
Yeah,
it's a rat burger. Yeah.
You don't want me to grill a beetle and then you just eat it?
Yeah, where do you stand? Do you put?
Can I do the Indiana Jones thing there?
I'd probably go beetle burger above Impossible Burger, though, if I'm being honest.
What?
No.
No?
No.
You don't knock it till you try it.
I'm not knocking it. I think it's
beetle meal.
Incredibly innovative solution. I mean... Hey, if you can make it work and it's healthy and, and all that kind of stuff, I ain't going to knock it. I can't believe the growth. When you said $3 billion, that is what blew me away.
Now. I mean, yeah. And then it's like, it's supposed to be like $8 billion.
And did you ever think you'd read a sentence along the lines of growth in the insect ingredient market or whatever? I mean, yeah.
It's becoming real. Yeah.
Entotarian. Jeff, any idea, any chance of being an entotarian in this lifetime?
Only if I have to, David.
Like your doctor comes to you and you're like, there's only one thing that's going to work. It's an entotarian diet. And you're just like, I unfortunately know what that is.
Yeah.
And I like my chances otherwise.
Well, I tell you the one thing though, I mean, a lot of people would obviously be resistant for obvious reasons, but you do throw a Tyson name on there and all of a sudden it's like, all right, this is a commodity type item almost.
They're going to make wasp any teasers. What, Tyson any?
Yeah, no, it's a...
They're
going to bread it and deep fry it.
Deep
and
then fry wasps.
You'll eat it with barbecue sauce. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Real good.
Frozen beetle burgers from Tyson. Maybe need to tweak the logo a little bit. I find it interesting. One thing is, you think of what food processing facilities and the entire food supply chain looks like, and it's a lot of logistics. Whereas when you think of a completely enclosed single plant or factory that could be the entire supply chain, I don't know. You're talking about a way more efficient process that's probably way cheaper. I don't know. I understand the allure of it.
Oh, yeah. Sure. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why it's much, much more sustainable.
I'm getting into the beetle farming. Why? Entotarianism.
Mm-hmm.
It's coming. It's coming. By 2050, it's here. Jeff, what is your In Case You Missed It this week?
So kind of playing off of our first story, I picked a story called Electrical Grids Aren't Keeping Up with the Green Energy Push. And I mean, we've talked about this before with the push for electric vehicles and just the strain that that's going to put on the grid in its current shape. It's not just here in the U.S. It's really around the world. So the article talked about a recent report from the International Energy Agency. The organization said in a report that the capacity to connect to and transmit electricity is not keeping pace with the rapid growth of clean energy technology such as solar and wind or electric vehicles. Went on to say that right now the stalled projects, and they talk about environmental concerns, bureaucratic processes more than anything else, have these projects stalling that could generate up to 1,500 gigawatts of power. That's about five times the amount of solar and wind capacity that was added worldwide last year. So basically, we have the technology, we have the ways of doing this. We're just being held up in a lot of bureaucratic processes that are allowing for the grid to be connected to these sources of energy. Right now, they're in trouble of missing a lot of the climate goals that have been established. They're talking about the need to refurbish up to 50 million miles of power lines by 2040 in order to get in with what they want to do in terms of some of their goals.
Whoa.
This equates to about $600 billion a year by 2030. Ugh. That's about double from what it is right now. And again, we're looking worldwide. So yeah, the scale is a little bit more manageable. We're not just looking here in the U.S., but still a ton of work that needs to be done. And I think it goes back to what we talked about in the first story there. We tried to create this marketplace and we tried to come up with this solution, but then we didn't think about some of the practical elements we needed to put in place to make it applicable to everyday life. And that's what's happening here. We've got the ways to create all of this wonderful energy and for clean sources. We just don't have the plug yet.
Yeah.
Well, and I think it kind of goes back to, again, another one of my favorite sayings that I always try to way to incorporate into everything. It's blocking and tackling.
Oh, I thought it was the other phrase.
No, this is definitely a blocking and tackling thing here. We need to go, in pace with what we're able to do, because otherwise it's unfortunate that there's this much wasted energy right now.
We need like the sound effect of like a line colliding. We're
exactly.
Just like blocking
exactly.
And tackling. One thing that stood out to me about this story is that it is kind of the confirmation that a lot of green energy naysayers were looking for in terms of we don't have the infrastructure yet. But it also, it's a good eye opener in terms of how far we still need to go. The one thing, the quote that stood out to me was the International Energy Agency Executive Director Fatih Birol said, quote, "It's like you are manufacturing a very efficient, very speedy, very handsome car, but you forgot to build the roads for it."
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think what I was really impressed with is how they could quantify how we're missing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that actually lends more credence to their case as opposed to those who are opposed to it. Because one of the things before is that's pie in the sky. You think it's going to do all this. And they're saying, this is exactly what we need.
Yeah.
This is how we can get there. So I was actually thought this more encouraging maybe than it was even meant to be.
No, well, I mean, that's a good point. And by wrapping some real numbers around it as to how to make it logistically feasible, it gives us real goals to work towards.
For sure. I agree. And then I think it's also a great reminder of, with like the infrastructure is boring line that this is what it is for. I mean, this is like achieving like a life sustaining goal that is to keep the temperature of the planet down. This is what we do with that money. So think about that the next time you think you can like kick the can down the road another couple years on infrastructure.
Right. We're running out of road. All right. In case you missed it this week, and before I get into it, Dan, I apologize for not getting to that comment. I tried sussing through the subsequent comments and putting it together, but just logistically, as we're moving, I couldn't get to it. So I apologize. I owe you one. My In Case You Missed It This Week came from the site Medical Design and Development. It's about a pilot program that's recycling 40,000 pounds of used medical devices. Medical technology company BD, also known as Becton Dickinson and Company, and Casella Waste Systems, a waste and recycling company, this week announced the results of a recycling pilot to manage discarded syringes and needles. The pilot led to 40,000 pounds of medical waste being recycled and diverted from disposal. The recycling pilot helps address a historic challenge within the healthcare industry, which in the United States alone, according to the Journal of Royal Society of Medicine, generates more than 3 billion pounds of plastic waste in the U.S. alone. Now, We talk about the problems with single-use plastics, but we don't talk about some of the problems that we face that are like even more dire, just because when it comes to the medical industry, you know, it's we need it. You know, it's mission critical, right? So we don't we worry about having the products and not necessarily what we do with the waste stream. Well, Becton Dickinson and Casella Waste are trying to figure out a potential solution, although it is a 40,000-pound dent in a 3 billion-pound problem. Now, the pilot was the first large-scale effort to assess the feasibility of recycling medical waste found in Red Sharps containers, which, again, are mostly syringes and needles, and you kind of see them everywhere. It's the thing that my kids always point out at the doctor's office. What's in here? I'm like, that's the one thing you don't touch. That's the one thing. And it's weirdly reachable. Weirdly reachable.
That's the only thing you don't touch?
Well, I mean.
At the doctor's office?
Yeah. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, don't go in that wastebasket because, oh, God. But, yeah, no. Stay away from the needles. I mean, stay away from it everywhere, like even in the DQ. The pilot also assessed technical feasibility of two types of technology, both mechanical and advanced recycling, and they both showed favorable results in the ability to successfully recycle used medical devices for use in other products. The next stage of this pilot is going to add more hospitals and focus on other types of medical materials and devices for recycling. I kind of spelled out why I think this is important and why this could make a big impact on the industry going forward, because there's a tremendous amount of waste in the medical industry. And because it's the medical industry, everyone's like, it's a necessary evil. So this is why I picked this story, because I just think it could make an incredible impact going forward and do something with all those pesky, dirty needles. Anna, your thoughts on the pilot program at BD?
Yeah, you could. I mean, if there's any industry where you can make the case for single-use plastic, this is the one. Yeah. I wonder if it's a target area because are some of these plastics higher quality and easier to recycle than, say, your classic water bottle that's just like made out of like garbage plastic and they can only get 20% back.
You're right. More of a pure plastic.
So that makes sense, I guess. Do you happen to know what they're producing?
No, they didn't say what. They just said that they were able to go in. They were able to be reused in other products. They didn't say what,
mm-hmm.
Which I can understand, because if they're making water bottles out of dirty needles, like, mm-hmm. People might not want to know that their Dasani bottle was made with old syringes, but they said that it was successfully recycled. So they kind of stopped short.
Okay. I'm sure they did do a little cleanup there.
Yeah,
I think it's going into like a vat of like, I don't know how many hundreds of degrees to melt down and stuff. So I think it's probably clean after that.
I'm sure it's clean. But you know, that is a branding problem that many people probably don't want to deal with.
Yeah, that's a branding problem that we don't need to deal with right now.
Yeah.
Like,
people are okay when it's a recycled ketchup packet, mm-hmm. you know, turned into a purse. You know, that's easier. We don't need to know that our shoe soles are made of syringes.
Hey, listen, I am all for any type of recycling initiative that works, mm-hmm. And doesn't require more energy to function than it produces in a benefit, from a sustainability standpoint. So obviously this needs to scale a little bit, but I mean, it's exciting to see like a recycling application that you never thought could possibly exist. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, probably a lot of, I know that we're just talking about tiny needles, but I bet there's a fair amount of metal in there that once you start working through the logistics of separating it, could be valuable as well, just because it's probably very high grade steel. Jeff, your thoughts on the pilot project?
Well, I think two things, obviously great.
Yeah.
I mean, good stuff. I think we need to get past, and I understand where you're coming from, but we can't think about it as 40,000 out of 3 billion.
Yeah.
We need to think about just 40,000 less.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's all those little steps that we can get there and scaling things up. So I think that's a tremendous success right there. The other thing, and going with my other cliche.
Yes, we're going to get them both. Are they recording this?
When you talk about the thing that leads to the thing.
Oh, yes. Yes, we got one.
Here we're just looking at healthcare. We're not even looking at pharmaceutical or medical device manufacturing, which also uses a ton of single-use plastic, especially in pharmaceuticals.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at everything there, and if we can figure out a way to recycle it at the end user level, we should also be able to figure out a way to recycle it at the production level. Mm-hmm. So it all bleeds together.
Yeah. And again, if they can do it sustainably with less energy put in than you do to make the raw materials, all the better. But yeah, just the tip of the iceberg. And I like how you set the table. You set the table with blocking and tackling, and then you're just like, Oh, I'm coming back.
That was amazing. And I just want you guys to know that if you deadpan the video team and ask them if they're recording this right now, you will get an eye roll and a thumbs up.
Sounds good. I saw it neither. I was just like, ooh, zero reaction.
Well, I can't see Eric's face, but I know when you're talking about the insects, he's got a good story when he was in Mexico about eating, I believe, crickets or grasshoppers.
Oh, I think it was crickets and sriracha.
Oof. Yeah. Oof. Yeah. I will get that one later.
Yeah, no, that's, but I thought they were like a little more fresh. It was a fresh, anyway. Let's move on to our final thoughts before we get out of here.
Fresh bugs.
Anna, what is your final thought this week?
So I know I had given you guys kind of a preview of the birthday party that I had planned for the weekend, which was, went off without a hitch. It was super fun. And my kids were like completely destroyed by it. Like by then they just were just like sugared out and they were exhausted. And I think that's like what you want out of a birthday party.
Absolutely.
Right. So it went very well, in that sense. The other thing I wanted to mention is I just, had the opportunity to serve on a podcast, a guest on a podcast yesterday called Subject to Talent. It's a podcast that's produced by, Allegis Global Solutions, and they do like workforce stuff. Basically, they're kind of like a staffing type organization, and so it was fun because they reach a huge audience of different career areas. And so I was able to talk about the industrial workforce challenges that are facing the industry. And I think maybe it will be a new topic for some of the folks that are listening, which is cool, I think, because sometimes you get on, you know, we're on all these industry podcasts and you hate to find yourself in an echo chamber. But in this case, I was like, well, maybe this is new to some of these folks. So anyway, it's going to come out in February. You got a while.
Yeah.
You don't have to clear anything off your calendar. It's not coming out till February. I'll remind you.
It can be your final thought until February.
Every day.
When it goes, until,
yeah.
Yep. Well, I mean, maybe it could be a little bit more advice. You know, when I was on the Made in America podcast, or no, Manufacturing Radio, and he just said, well, we'll just take every Ukrainian refugee, put them to work in manufacturing. Boom, crisis over. And a couple of people reached out and they're like, I don't think it's that easy. My final thought this week was that last night I had the ability to go to a local STEAM event. The DeForest school system put on this STEAM event and I kind of didn't know what I was getting into because, you know, it's a smaller town. It's a smaller school district. But it was an entire gymnasium of all these different tables, at least like 20 to 25 different tables. And my kids loved it.
Yeah.
There was everything from touching human organs, which was crazy. And they even slipped in a little like, those lungs were from a smoker. That's why they're so black. I'm like, oh, God, okay, thank you, thank you. But they went through all different types of STEAM and STEM activities from building marble runs to playing with STEM focused games from the library where you are doing rudimentary programming. There's a 3D printed pen. We made catapults. We were using beans to learn math. We made something called cornstarch plastic, which is incredibly messy and still on my hands. And they got to make beeswax too. It was an incredible event where I, at a very personal level, you know, we report on these all the time, these events where they're happening and we don't necessarily get to go to all of them. And going to a small one on a local level, I just want to applaud the efforts of the local school district. And these things don't happen without corporate leaders in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to thank Evco Plastics. The photo that we have up right now, this is the Evco Plastics, which is based in DeForest. They had a booth where they just had a little cobot and it was doing a little pick and place application with these 3D printed parts. And what you're seeing are my kids' minds being blown.
That's
they're just
awesome.
Like, I hit the red button and it stops and I hit the green button and it goes. And if I get close to the robot, it doesn't move. I'm just like, yeah. And then they're like, do you want some glasses that say Evco Plastics? And both my boys were like, no, thank you. And they're just like, you get the last two. And I'm like, I'm sorry. They're going to take a Snickers bar and a York peppermint patty and just watch the robot. But it was an incredible event. And I just want to encourage anyone else that's either a reader or a listener or however you're involved in the manufacturing industry to seek out your local school districts. See when they have events like this planned. And it doesn't take a lot. Like you think you got to go to a STEAM event. You got to have some sort of crazy display. but I think it was Graph Engineering. They're like a architectural engineering firm. They just had a giant box from Mario that actually changed changed the color of light in the box with the same lights that were used to light the studio.
Nice.
And so like the boys were like, I know this remote control. Like, all right, we played with it like literally earlier today. So just get out and get involved with it because you can make a big impact on a lot of lives. There were a bunch of kids there and they loved all of it. It was really cool. Really yeah. cool. Jeff, your final thought this week.
I don't know if I can top that. Your enthusiasm is inspiring, David. That was very cool.
It's because I was inspired. I was just like, oh, well, at least there's pizza, you know? And the first one was kind of a bust because it was like, the middle school robotics team made all these robots that were supposed to, and they scattered candy across the gym floor, but they didn't think about how tall the candy was. Yeah. So you couldn't pick it up with the robot. So it was more of a like candy scooting robot. Okay. So at first I'm like, okay, I see where the bar is at. But then we went immediately to human hearts and brains. I'm like, oh, we're in.
Yeah. No, those first teams, those robotic teams are awesome. Eric actually did a great video at Rockwell's Automation Fair last year with some of their first team. So that's on the site. Try to find that and check it out. That was awesome. Closing thoughts. You know, I was also had a chance to go on a podcast this week. So I just wanted to thank Ron Pereira and the guys at Kemba Academy for having me on their show. Talked about cybersecurity and continuous improvement strategies and just some general trends in manufacturing right now. But Ron was a great guy, fun to talk to. So it was a good time. So check them out. The other thing I was going to say is, so while Anna was having this massive birthday celebration, I was with some friends and family and we ended up at a dueling pianos.
Yeah. Type thing.
Now, any place I can sit down, have a couple cocktails, relax on a Saturday night, I'm not real particular. Like mm-hmm. I can make it work. But I was not that enthused about going to dueling pianos. And for anybody else who might be thinking this is not my thing, these guys were pretty amazing. I mean, I never heard Buck Cherry and Def Leppard on a piano before. Mm-hmm. So they can pull that off. Yeah. You will be entertained. So, yeah. You know, stay open-minded, I guess.
Yeah.
It's strangely like the most fun ever.
It was really good. They were great.
Did they do it where they'll play a song and they'll play it until someone pays more to get another song played?
No, it was two guys. And man, they were just going one after another. Yeah, it was impressive what they were pulling out.
No, it's fun. It's like, and it's weirdly more fun than like going to karaoke.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, these guys could actually sing.
Very good. Well, before we get out of here this week, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You could also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, David, or Anna at IN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You could also subscribe to our daily newsletter. Make sure you get it delivered to your inbox first. And subscribe to us on YouTube at IN Magazine so you can comment like Dan did, and I'll mangle it so bad it doesn't even make air. But for Jeff Rankin and Anna Wells, I'm David Manti. This is the Today in Manufacturing podcast, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Today in Manufacturing podcast.